country. Our coverage begins at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central, and 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and includes Spanish language coverage and analysis. The Pacifica Radio Network, 70 years serving 100% of the 99.
Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals Thursday, 8 p.m. and time for So What's Your Story? We're the only program originating in Houston devoted to live storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm Warren Holloman, and tonight I'll be your host. Each week we celebrate the power of story by bringing you remarkable tellers who take us on captivating journeys, and then they return us safely home. We like to feature a variety of stories on this show. We feature fiction. We've had a number of local short story authors on the show. We've also read you stories by such luminaries as Edgar Allan Poe, O. Henry, and Raymond Carver. And then there's traditional stories. Our stories run the gamut from children's fairy tales to Irish folk tales, African Native American folk tales, to religious myths and parables. And then we do nonfiction or memoir, personal stories. If you tuned in last week, for example, you heard Dr. Michael Schaefer, a pediatric plastic surgeon, share stories about the challenge of working with patients who suffer from facial deformities. You also heard a story by Dr. Erica Brown about her first day on a rather unique new job, teaching creative writing to pediatric patients at MD Anderson Cancer Center. So there's fiction or short story, there's traditional stories, there's personal stories. Tonight, we're going to do something different and explore the way that music serves as a vehicle for telling a story. Some of the greatest music ever written and some of the most popular stories of all time are found in the classic genre known as opera. But have you ever noticed how some of us get intimidated by opera? I'm not sure why. But perhaps tonight we can figure that out, because tonight's guests have made it their mission to take the intimidation out of opera and to put the fun back in. They are, of course, St. John Flynn and Eric Skelly of the Opera Cheat Sheet, and they're back for the third year in a row to perform a live podcast. Tonight they'll be telling the story of perhaps the most popular opera of all time. St. John, Eric, welcome back to So What's Your Story?
Thanks for having us back. I can't believe you keep asking us to come back.
Yeah, we very much appreciate being here.
We love having you. St. John, I'll start with you. I first met you, of course, at that other radio station when you hosted The Front Row on KUHF.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an absolutely incredible radio show, and I still miss it. But you were also a cast member, more recently, for an Emmy Award-winning television show. Tell our non-Anglophile listeners what Manner of Speaking was all about.
Manner of Speaking was produced by Houston Public Media and syndicated to public TV stations around the country. And what it was a half-hour after show for Downton Abbey. Downton Abbey on PBS was such a hit with so many people watching, and it became a real cultural phenomenon. And one of my colleagues at Houston Public Media, Ernie Manous, had the great idea of harnessing that and turning it into, a half-hour after show. So on a Sunday evening after the Downton Abbey episode had aired, then we had this pre-produced story, half-hour of looking back over the episode and talking about some of the themes and bitching about some of the, things that could be bitched about. And it was fun. It was tongue in cheek, but it was also serious. Mm-hmm. There were focusing on those things that I think made Downton Abbey so important to so many people.
And I should point out that there's a pun involved. Manner is spelled M-A-N-O-R.
Right.
Manner of speaking. Eric, you're the Senior Director of Communications for the Houston Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah.
What does that involve?
What does that mean?
Yeah.
What do I do during the day? Primarily, it is it entails media relations and public relations.
Uh-huh.
So working with the media in Houston to tell the story of the Houston Symphony. I also work with our team who produces our in-house magazine, InTune Magazine.
Uh-huh.
I host and associate produce the radio broadcasts of the Houston Symphony.
Sunday nights, 8 p.m.
Sunday nights at 8. And, various and sundry other duties as assigned. But those are the principal areas. And then mm-hmm. I also, with my colleague Calvin Dotsey, who is our program editor and does an amazing job with that. He and I do a series of talks. It started with the staff, but now we do them for major donors about upcoming repertoire and talk about who the performers are and what the repertoire is and just let them know what they're about to hear.
What a job.
Yeah, it keeps me busy, and it's the best job ever.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. In addition to your individual careers, the two of you have partnered to produce one of the longest-running podcasts I know of, the Opera... How's that?
Makes it sound old.
The Opera Cheat Sheet. What is it about opera you find so fascinating?
Oh, boy. How long do we have?
Well, when I was at Houston Public Media on 88.7 and 91.7, when we had 91.7, we would always broadcast the Met Opera on a Saturday afternoon.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that I was always looking for was ways to expand our opera programming. Mm-hmm. And so I came up with the idea of, I knew Eric and I worked together at Houston Public Media, and Eric is the world authority on opera. He is somebody who who knows it very intimately. I love opera, mm-hmm. and I've seen a lot of operas, and I know a lot about it, but nothing compared to Eric. And so I thought we could bring those two, the two of us together, and for each broadcast, Met broadcast on a Saturday afternoon, we would do a half hour, however long it was a podcast, so it could be as long as it wanted to be, talking about the opera that was going to play on Saturday and, explaining what was going to happen, talking about the story, the music, what it is about different operas that make them the standout mm-hmm. that they are. Mm-hmm. And inevitably, we did it with some humor.
And it got easier and better as we went, but really from the very beginning, it was lightning in a bottle. The two of us mm-hmm. just clicked.
Chemistry.
I mean, it's chemistry, and it's also skill sets and knowledge bases that complement one another uh-huh. beautifully.
Yeah.
So St. John was kind enough to say, that I brought the opera expertise to the table, but he brought the producer's knowledge of how to do a broadcast and how to construct it from beginning to end, beginning, middle, end, mm-hmm. And make it cohesive. And it was, as I said, lightning in a bottle. It was great.
How many podcasts have you done so far?
Mm. Goodness.
No idea. Really?
We must have done over 100.
Oh, well over 100, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's incredible. Well, back in 2018, you retold the story of Jacques Offenbach's comic opera, The Tales of Hoffman, which is a rather sophisticated narrative, if you think about it, because it's a bunch of tiny narratives that together comprise one big narrative.
Yeah.
Last year, you retold another classic, Beethoven's Fidelio, which had a lot of relevance, I think, to current social and political situations. What have you got for us tonight?
We're going with Verdi's La Traviata.
Ah, Well, let's hear it.
Okay. Well, welcome to the Opera Cheat Sheet. I'm St. John Flynn.
And I'm Eric Skelly.
And this time, we're talking about Giuseppe Verdi's La Traviata. Which,
the Fallen Woman.
That's right. It debuted in 1853 at La Fenice, the famous opera house in Venice.
And was a famous flop.
It was.
It was terribly, horribly received on its opening night. Apparently the tenor was just not any good, and the soprano was, well...
stout.
Substantial. Well, and not believable as a consumptive...
And also, one of the things I think that turned the audience off was that it was set in that day.
Yeah.
Because it's based on Alexandre Dumas' play, The Lady of the Camellias.
Right.
Which takes place in Paris in the late 1840s. And so audiences... The Venice Opera House.
We don't want to see people dressed like us.
Right. They wanted to see something from the past. And when we think of opera today, we do still tend to think of it as being, them old years, you know, centuries ago. And, if you see a contemporary opera, it's jarring because you expect to see more lace and pantaloons.
Yeah. Unless you're in Germany and they've set the ring cycle in a taco stand, in which case all bets are off.
As Eric said, La Traviata is the fallen woman. And that fallen woman is our central character. Her name is Violetta Valerie. And she is a courtesan. Yes. And I will let you explain what that is.
Well, she's not a hoe. We have to establish that from the get-go. But she's kind of hoe adjacent. Can we agree to that? Because right. Otherwise we don't have a plot.
Yeah, the courtesans were intelligent, educated, beautiful women who... They were sort of like, in some respects, like Japanese geisha.
Mm-hmm.
That they would provide companionship to... gentlemen from the upper echelons of society, shall we say.
Sort of like a kept woman, except there's there was a society in Paris of these courtesans at the time. They literally had their own, they called it the demi-monde. And as St. John, as you said, they were very cultivated and cultured and well-read. And
But they did live off of their gentleman friends.
Yeah.
And there could be a physical relationship. But they were known as being interesting. And, they would hold, they would have not just parties, but they would hold salons where, the great minds of the day might come together to discuss, politics or religion or literature or... And so the courtesan is something that I don't think exists today.
No, they didn't ever discuss the sort of transactional nature of their relationships. It was something that just wasn't spoken of, which becomes a part of the plot of this opera.
Violetta is a young girl. She's in her early 20s. We said that the opera was taken from Dumas' play, The Lady with the Camellias.
Which some people might know from the film Camille with Greta Garbo.
Right. And Alexandre Dumas adapted the play from his novel of the same name, and the novel was based upon, it was a fictionalized telling of his relationship with this courtesan,
Marie Duplessis,
who was, a historical figure.
Yeah.
And she died at the age of 23. So Violetta she's young, but she has contracted tuberculosis.
Yes.
And at the opening of the opera, the curtain goes up and there's this huge party going on at Violetta's house.
Right.
And
one of her guests, Gaston, arrives with this young man, Alfredo Germont, this young... How would we describe Alfredo? He's
He's from a well-to-do family, but not a noble family.
The bourgeoisie is where he's from. And he has been admiring Violetta. In fact, she recently, as we learn, had a bout of illness with her consumption.
And this party is her coming back into society.
Yes, exactly. And during her illness, she's told that he came to call to find out how she was doing every single day that she was laid up.
And what's interesting is that Germont is obviously head over heels. Alfredi was obviously head over heels for her. But she doesn't believe it or can't believe it. She's very skeptical.
She's skeptical, but she's intrigued. She's touched by the fact that he came to visit while she was ill. But she's, as you say, skeptical. And so this leads into the first and probably the most famous number in the entire score, in which Alfredo is exhorted by the crowd to propose a toast. This is the Brindisi. And it's, as I said, one of the most famous numbers in all of opera. And he toasts love. And then the chorus comes in, and then she...
Violetta comes in, and she toasts pleasure.
Yeah, a little cynical.
And that's one of the big themes of the opera, of course, is love versus pleasure.
Right.
And he is, at the beginning, he is the representative of love, which, of course, is what he's feeling for Violetta. Violetta, though, is all about pleasure, because... everything for her has been transactional.
Yes.
And the relationships she's had have never been based on love.
And she is cynical. She doesn't believe at this point that love even exists, despite the fact that she is, as you say, a very young woman.
And she actually says, as she sings her verse in the drinking song, the Brindisi, "Everything is folly in the world that does not give us pleasure. For the pleasures of love are swift and fleeting as a flower that lives and dies and can be enjoyed no more."
Mm-hmm.
And she gives Alfredo a flower. And she says, "Bring it back when it's withered, when it's wilted."
Yeah.
And there's a sort of a tease in there, because she's inviting him to come back. So she is intrigued. She does want to find out more about this man.
And at the same time, there's some major symbolism going on, because she is the lady of the camellias, and she gives him a camellia and says, "Bring it back when it's withered." And here is this young woman who should be in the prime of life, and as we'll find out, she isn't.
Right. And in fact, in real life, Marie Duplessis, Alexandre Dumas' courtesan, she used to wear a white camellia.
Yeah.
And she liked camellias because they had no fragrance, they had no scent, because she couldn't stand that.
Right.
Here's the funny thing, though. Well, it's not funny, but whenever she was in her menstrual cycle, she would wear a red camellia. And that was a signal to her suitors that she wasn't available. But then, you know, once the menstrual cycle was over, she'd be out wearing the white again, and you know, the gentleman knew
open
that
for
she
business.
Was open for business.
Sorry,
but that idea of flowers, we get that. You know, obviously Violetta, the violet.
Yeah.
Her friend is Flora. And she gives Alfredo this flower, which is her. And she says, "Bring it back when it's wilted."
Yeah.
But she is intrigued.
Very much so. And so once everyone disperses and the party, you know, either is ended or they go off to someone else's house, we're not sure.
Well, they go in the other room to dance. And she's left. She thinks she's alone in her drawing room. And she has an episode. She feels weak, and she starts coughing because she's sick. And she doesn't realize that Alfredo is behind her.
Oh, okay. I'm further on than you are, okay. So go ahead.
No, but that's when they have this time alone together.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as you say, you know, it the party gets back together again.
Right. And then they go off on their merry way into the evening. And she is left completely alone. And alone with her thoughts. And this is where we have the first of her big arias. And it's a dual aria, because we're still... Verdi is still hewing somewhat to his bel canto roots, which means that there are formal structures with the way things work here. Arias come in pairs. First, you have a cavatina, which is the slow aria, which shows off the singer's long, beautiful, seamless legato lines, you know, able to, you know, sing these impossibly long lines in one breath. And then they follow that with a cabaletta, which is fast and showy and lots of coloratura, fireworks. So the cavatina here is A Forse Lui. Maybe it's him, she sings. Maybe. Could it be? Could love actually exist? And could this guy, this Alfredo, really...
He could be the one.
Be the
could
one.
Could he be the one?
Could he be the one?
Because she has never felt that love, that sort of love, before.
Right.
And so she questions.
Right.
But
then she were. Then she says, "Nah, nah." Nah. And that's what triggers the cabaletta. When the cabaletta is called "Sempre Libera," always free. She says, "No, love, forget it. I am all about fun." Joyir, she sings.
And again, she's returning to her theme of pleasure. You know, she's had this question. She's sort of dipping her toe in the water of love, if you like. But she's like, pleasure's good.
Yeah.
Let's just stick with pleasure.
Yeah. So Sempre Libera is this huge coloratura showpiece. And this is why this role is so difficult to cast, because... as we'll find out in the next two acts, it really requires a singer with three different voices. In the first act, you have to have someone who can handle the coloratura, fireworks of Sempre Libera, and the duet she has with Alfredo has all kinds of coloratura, spectacular, you know, intervallic leaps, and you name it. And she has to negotiate all that and make it seem easy. And then in the second act, as we'll hear, she sings this big, passionate outburst, "Ah, Mami Alfredo," and big, passionate outbursts in her scene with Giorgio Germont, and it really requires a spinto soprano, a soprano that is more than a lyric, but, a pushed lyric is what spinto means. So it's a bigger voice. And then in the last act, it requires absolute, seamless lyricism. So three different voices, one singer. Good luck.
But when she's finished Sempre Libera, end of Act 1.
End of Act 1.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to So What's Your Story on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. My guests are St. John Flynn and Eric Skelly of the opera Cheat Cheat fame, and they're retelling the story of La Traviata by Giuseppe Verdi. Act 2.
Act 2 is... several months later, and we are transported to the countryside outside Paris. And there, Violetta and Alfredo are living together in this country house, and they are blissfully in love.
Absolutely. And we open with him. He has this wonderful aria, "De miei bollenti spiriti," my buoyed spirits. He's so happy. He can't believe how happy he is living with her in the countryside at her country home.
It's this sort of pastoral bliss. You know, she's left her old life behind in the city, the life of a courtesan. They've moved to the country. And, you know, like shepherds and shepherdesses, and you know, everybody falls in love. And she and Alfredo are committed to each other exclusively.
However, his pie in the sky, you know, rose colored vision of how his life is going is pretty quickly shattered when the maid Anina comes in and he finds out from Anina. You know, he's young and he's naive, and it just never has occurred to him, how are we paying for all this?
Right.
And she tells him, Violetta, because she has given up the life of a courtesan, has been hawking her jewels all along to keep paying the bills and allow them to have this life out in the country.
And she has gone into Paris again to sell horses, to sell the carriages. I mean, as a courtesan, she earned good money.
Yeah.
You know, but of course she doesn't have that source of income now.
And he doesn't either.
And he doesn't either. And so he is shocked by this, right?
Right.
And Anina tells him that Violetta did not want him to know what she was doing.
Yes.
His immediate reaction is, he says, okay, I'm going to go to Paris, and I'm going to get this taken care of.
Yep.
That is his commitment to her.
Yeah.
And, you know, he understands that he has to be a man. He has to step up, do his thing.
Right.
And so off he goes.
He goes to Paris.
To Paris.
Violetta, meanwhile, returns. And Anina gives her an invitation from Flora to a party at Flora's house for that evening. And Violetta just kind of laughs it off. No, no, no. You know, she says, I'm done with that life, and just sets it aside. And then someone is announced. She has a visitor.
Mm-hmm.
She's expecting someone else, but it turns out to be
Giorgio Germain, Alfredo's father.
Ooh. Oh, boy.
And he has come, and Alfredo was sort of half expecting him, but of course Alfredo's not there.
Right.
He has come on a dastardly mission. He has come to ask Violetta to give Alfredo up.
Yeah. For two reasons. For Alfredo's sake, and also for the sake of his daughter, that is, Giorgio's daughter, Alfredo's sister. She is engaged to be wed to a wealthy family, but they found out that Alfredo is living with Violetta, who has a checkered past, and they are, you know, if that still is the case, they're willing to just call it all off.
Right. And Giorgio is, when he comes in, he's haughty. He's arrogant.
Ugh.
He's looking down on Violetta because of her past as a courtesan.
Right.
And he asks her, basically he's telling her, you have to give Alfredo up because it's ruining our family.
Yeah. She initially is just completely affronted and pretty much almost asks him to leave. But then he makes the case with an aria. Pura si come un angelo, pure as an angel. He describes his daughter and how basically what a nasty piece of work. He lays it at her feet and says, you hold my daughter's future in your hands. Not just Alfredo's, but this pure angelic daughter of mine.
The amazing thing, and this is where the whole opera turns, is that Violetta says, okay, she understands that her love for Alfredo, if you love someone, set them free.
Yeah.
You know, and she agrees to give him up.
Knowing that it will most assuredly hasten her demise, because she knows that
she doesn't have long for the world.
She does not have long to live, exactly.
And what's interesting throughout their musical dialogue is how Giorgio comes to respect her and to feel that his initial
arrogance.
Yeah.
And
his initial view of her
was
wrong, and he was not expecting her to be so magnanimous.
And he starts to actually feel paternal feelings toward her, although not strong enough to change his mind and not ask this horrible thing of her that he does.
So he's made his case, and Violetta has agreed that she will break it off with Alfredo.
Yeah.
And Giorgio leaves.
Yeah. She writes to Flora and says, I'll be at that party tonight, after all. And then writes a letter for Alfredo, but keeps it on her person. And then Alfredo himself returns. And she isn't letting on anything. She doesn't let him know that his father's there. She doesn't let him know that any of that has happened. She just says she has to go out on an errand. But before she does, she says goodbye. And she says goodbye in the grandest statement in all of opera, the phrase, Amami Alfredo. She says to him, love me, Alfredo, knowing that this is potentially the last time she'll ever see him.
She has those two lines. Love me, Alfredo, as much as I love you.
As I love you.
And then she says, addio. God be with you. Goodbye. It's not au revoir. It's adieu.
Goodbye.
Right.
Yeah. Leaving him probably wondering, wow, that was that was a really dramatic farewell, but okay.
And so, at what point does Alfredo realize?
Well, after she leaves, not terribly long after, someone comes in with a letter in her handwriting and hands it to him. He opens it and reads it and just collapses emotionally.
Right.
As he realizes what that really was. Goodbye. Permanently.
And then his father comes back.
Yeah.
And boy, oh boy, that's a conversation and a half.
Oh, boy. Yeah, well, his father then, not letting on that he's behind this, comforts him. And he comforts him, of course, with an aria, Di Provenza in Mar, where he fills Alfredo's heads with returning to Provence. And
which is where the family is from.
Where the family is from. And how comforting that will be. And this aria is so beautiful. It's a lullaby. It's really a lullaby. It's a father singing a lullaby to his son.
And the family, the Germain family, at the end of Act Two, seems to be reunited and their prospects have been restored, etc.
So we think.
Yeah.
Act Two, Scene One.
Right.
Yes. Act Two, Scene Two.
Right.
Takes us to the party at Flora's house, which is in full
that
swing.
That evening.
Yeah, that evening. It's in full swing. Violetta is there with the Baron Dufol, her patron, quote-unquote.
they had had an ongoing relationship in the past.
Yes.
And she, in fact, had given the Baron up.
For Alfredo.
For Alfredo.
Yeah. But now she's back with him. And she's there at the party, and I think it's Flora that sort of warns her, Alfredo is here.
Right. And she's worried.
Yeah.
Because she knows that the Baron is jealous and might have malevolent feelings toward Alfredo.
And Alfredo, having blood in his eye, may be just the powder keg to set the Baron off. So.
And Alfredo is gambling.
Right.
And he's doing very well. He's winning, and he's winning, and he's winning. And the Baron gets involved in, I think it's cards, I don't know.
Yeah.
And of course, Alfredo continues his winning streak, and the Baron gets more and more frustrated and angry.
Yeah. Yeah. Then the action, transitions to a side chamber where Violetta has arranged to meet Alfredo. And the two of them talk. She still isn't letting him know why she left him. And she claims that she still loves the Baron.
Right.
But she's warning him. She's trying to get him to leave
yeah.
before anything happens between he and the Baron. And he asks her, you know, do you love the Baron? And she says, yes, I do. She lies. And that just sets him off. So he calls everyone in to witness. And he turns on Violetta, takes all of his winnings from the gambling table, and throws them at her.
Mm-hmm.
As if a payment for services rendered.
Well, and he says,
"Yeah,
this is, you know, I'm paying her back all the... she, you know, spent on me.
Yeah.
But it was just the way he did it. And also what he's doing is he is reinforcing that traditional Violetta relationship, that transactional courtesan relationship.
Yeah.
And and he is just reconfirming Violetta as a courtesan.
Yeah. She collapses completely. At that moment, who should turn up? But Giorgio Germont, his father, who denounces him for his horrible behavior toward Violetta.
And he, he takes his son to task.
Yeah. But still doesn't tell him what he did. Still is maintaining the charade. And the scene ends with a huge ensemble where Violetta is just... completely collapsed. Alfredo is stricken with remorse.
And the Baron and Alfredo have agreed to a duel.
Yeah.
End of Act 2?
End of Act 2.
Act 3 is later. Later in the year. And as the curtain goes up on Act 3, we are in Violetta's bedroom.
The music is the same music that opened the opera, and it is very fragile music and very sad because she is on in her very last hours alive.
Yeah.
She is the consumption has taken hold, and she is not long for this world.
And she knows it.
Absolutely.
And she asks Anina to go and get the doctor. And the doctor arrives, and he knows that she is waiting for Alfredo to come back. Because in between Act 2 and Act 3, a lot has happened.
Yeah.
And Alfredo has found out the truth about what his father has done.
We don't know that yet.
We don't know that yet.
We know that because we get... So Violetta gets a letter. She gets the letter first. Sorry. She gets the letter from Giorgio Germont. And the letter tells her that he's heard of the downturn in her health.
Right.
He's gone to Alfredo, told him everything. And that Alfredo is on his way back to her. And he says, all's going to be well. And she's reading this. The actress playing Violetta literally reads it. She doesn't sing it. She reads it. And at the end, she says, "E tardi." It's too late.
Yeah.
It's too late. And then she sings this exquisite aria. It's called Addio del Passato. Good farewell to the past, farewell to everything. She is saying goodbye to life in this aria. And it's exquisite beyond anything that I can describe. You just have to hear it.
Again, we have that tension. Obviously here it's between life and death, between love and death.
Yeah.
And, she realizes it's almost like she has this huge regret that she ever gave in to her feelings for Alfredo, because it's been nothing but pain. Right? And obviously she associates her consumption and her failing health, she sees that as being sort of the byproduct of this failed relationship.
Yeah, or even punishment, in a sense. You know, she sees nothing. She looks into the past and sees nothing but pain and regret.
When the doctor comes in, and you know, he examines her, and he says, "Oh, you know, you're rallying."
Yeah, but
and
he's
as
lying.
He's leaving,
he's lying.
He says to Anina,
"She's got hours, just a few more hours." Yeah,
and then Alfredo arrives,
and she can't believe it. She's just overjoyed,
and she rallies.
Yeah.
It's almost like she's got a second wind.
Yeah, and he's telling her, you know, it's going to be fine now. We're going to live in Paris, and they sing this beautiful duet, Parigi o Cara, where they imagine the life they're going to live together in Paris now, and everything's going to be okay. And, you know, and then she actually tries to get up, and she can't.
She can't. She can't.
She sings "Non posso," and she's almost crying when she says it. I can't. And then Giorgio Germont shows up.
He's always showing up.
He's always showing up. Miserable. So and so. And
he is the most contrite person in the world.
As well, he should be. So she's on her last. She's in her last moments, and then something happens that, as I understand it, happens cruelly in the case of tuberculosis patients. At the very, very end, they suddenly feel this resurgence of life, and they feel great. And she does this, and she says, "I feel rinasce, I feel renewed, I feel great. Oh, joy!" And she sings "Oh Gioia" on this high note, and falls dead.
Right, and that's basically the end of the opera.
That is it.
I want to talk a little bit about the title, La Traviata.
Yeah,
because it gets translated in many different ways. It comes from the Italian verb traviare, which means to go astray or to lead astray. And people think that it's a reference to Violetta being a courtesan, that she has gone astray. But you can make the case that, in fact, she has been led astray
by Alfredo
Giorgio.
And Giorgio.
Giorgio, she has allowed Giorgio to split up herself and Alfredo, and that, you know, has brought about her demise.
Yeah, or you could make the case that Alfredo led her astray by actually showing her real love and leading her away from the life that she knew.
It's a fascinating dilemma that she has. You know, you feel so glad that finally she can feel love.
Yeah.
And then it's taken away. So horribly.
Yeah.
And so unnecessarily.
Cruelly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, that is Giuseppe Verdi's La Traviata. This week's Opera Cheat Sheet. I'm St. John Flynn.
And I'm Eric Skelly.
Thank you for listening.
Bravo, guys. I say this every year, but I'm struck. I feel... sitting here watching you do this, I'm just always struck by how much you enjoy doing this, how much you enjoy talking about or retelling an opera story.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because we get to discuss it. You know, mm-hmm. It's not just a question of, well, this happened, then this happened, then this happened. You know, you can tease different themes and significance, and you can also talk about the music.
Yeah. The music is everything. The music is what elevates it.
Yeah.
It's what... we were talking about this before. It's opera, when it hits, when everything is working in concert and in perfect marriage with one another, and you have, you know, you have the words, you have the dramaturgy, you have the music, you have the scenery, you have the costumes. When it all works together perfectly, it is... there's nothing that compares to it.
Right. Right. And one of the things I think that makes Verdi's most popular opera up until 1853 was Il Trovatore, which he had written just a few years before.
Yeah.
And when Traviata, after its terrible debut, it soon gained a wonderful reputation, and it became Verdi's most popular opera in his day, because Verdi didn't die until 1901.
Yeah.
And it's on the one hand, it's so well known. It's one of the most performed operas, but on the other hand, it's so deep, and it talks about very human things. And I think one of the things that makes opera such a good story is that it does talk about things that are universal.
And like with any great opera or even great play, you as an actor, or in this case a singer-actor, have so many different ways that you can play the character, so many different slants that you could put on it, so many different... The characters are so three-dimensional and so well-rounded that you can focus on different aspects of the character and bring those to the fore or de-emphasize those. And that makes every single time you see it different and interesting.
Well, I'm going to give you guys a chance to catch your breath, and we're going to pick this up in about 3 minutes.
Okay.
And meanwhile, I'm going to let Justin catch us up on what's happening in the world of Houston storytelling. Justin?
Well, Houston is a solid hub for storytelling, so there are plenty of options for everybody. Let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild hosts a story swap on the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, located at 1500 Sunset, directly across from Rice University. It is a great place to develop your love for stories. For more information about the Guild's event, like their annual Liars Contest on April 4th, go to www.houstonstorytellers.org. And while you're there, why not become a member? You can conveniently do it online. Don't leave their webpage before clicking on Radio Program on the menu to enjoy hundreds of shows since 2008. So What's Your Story was the first storytelling scene in Houston, and it is the seed that helped grow our storytelling community. So please enjoy our past programs and continue to tune in every week for live stories that connect us to each other. No radio, no problem, because you can catch us online anywhere on the globe at www.kpft.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And if you have program ideas, questions about storytelling, or suggestions for guest storytellers, drop us a note at story@kpft.org, and we promise to get back to you. If you want to take your storytelling skills to the next level, the Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network are waiting for you to become a member. Check them out online. Our friends at the Moth hold their annual monthly swap on the second Tuesday of the month at Warehouse Live. The next one is March 10th with the theme Challenges. It is a great place to listen to some terrific stories. And don't forget to tune in to our show next week, where Harwood and Chris are hosting, and their guest will be Don Akers, a former Golden Gloves boxing champion. Warren, back to you, and our guest, St. John Flynn and Eric Skelly of the opera Cheat Sheet.
Thanks, Justin, and I'm going to ask you to stay with us along with Hank, who's been waiting in the wings. I thought it would be fun to just have the two of you kick off the last segment of the show by giving us your impressions of the story you heard tonight. So, Justin, you go first, and then Hank.
Okay, well, I have to admit I'm one of the people that was a little intimidated by opera. Mostly because the understanding, I guess. But after hearing it described so well and put into easier to understand words for myself, it's very interesting, and now I'm more interested in opera. And it's almost as if the storyline could be a TV show on Netflix or something. It's just so relatable and dramatic, and I think I love the drama of the whole thing. That's my favorite part.
So not maybe not a convert yet, but an acolyte, is that the right word? Cool. How about you, Hank?
Well, I enjoy this every year. I really do enjoy it when you two guys come here because I don't know anything about opera. I mean, I'm married to a person who works for the Houston Ballet Orchestra, so I'm still trying to get acclimated to ballet. But I'm working my way to opera as well. And what I do love about opera is the fact that it is a great way of telling a story. And that doesn't sound very profound, but it is to a person who doesn't know much about opera. And I know that we talked a little bit earlier, and Eric, you were saying that you could drive someplace, Austin, San Antonio, you can put an opera in and be entertained the entire way.
Well, I mean, people are always mm-hmm. telling me, you know, they love to listen to books on tape mm-hmm. and to, you know, to Audible and things like that. And
right.
that's not for me, but part of the reason that it's not is because I already have that with opera.
Right.
As you say, if I'm driving to Austin or San Antonio or someplace, or if I'm flying somewhere, I will put on an opera, and I not only have the greatest music ever written mm-hmm. in my ear, but I can hear the story being told, and
yeah.
I can visualize it. And sometimes that's even more fun, to use my imagination and have my mind's eye create the world for me, and,
yes.
and to create the yeah. mise-en-scène. And it's like having a book on tape,
mm-hmm.
but it's, as we talked before, it's got the music to elevate it beyond anything that just a straightforward telling of that story could do for me.
And it is story in form. It's not it is story in form. It's not the same thing, but for me, listening to Pete Seeger, for example, which is the antithesis of what we're talking about in some ways.
Yeah,
but
not necessarily.
But I create images in my mind. Mm-hmm. And when I listen to opera, until I become really familiar with the genre, it's hard to conjure up those images. But as we become more familiar with it.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Pete Seeger was a folk singer. And so, you
sure.
know, you're having folk songs that do. Mm-hmm. And we have it in opera. We have Wagner's The Flying Dutchman. And a lot of the German romantic operas mm-hmm. use folk tunes and folk song
yeah.
form to tell the story. Zenta sings this aria in The Flying Dutchman, where she tells the story of The Flying Dutchman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much like a great folk song, like Gordon Lightfoot, you know, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, or something like that, where the whole
right.
story is laid out
yes.
in that aria.
Mm-hmm.
It's the exact same thing.
Yeah.
It's just
yeah.
a different musical genre.
And I think... Mm-hmm. I was going to say, if you look at opera, many, many operas are adaptations of other stories, whether it be a novel or a play. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you know, La Traviata is a prime example. Why? Because they want to tell a good story. A
yeah.
good story that has been, it was a play.
Mm-hmm.
Or it was a novel, or it was a poem, or whatever.
Right.
And they see, something like Verdi sees a story and thinks, you know what, that would make a fantastic opera.
Mm-hmm.
And so mm-hmm. yeah, and there is almost a crystallizing of story, because what the opera will do is it can't go into the intricacies of a play or a novel. And so you boil it down to one central story. And the focus is, therefore, very much on the story.
For me, what an opera does is set a tone. It sets a mood better than anything else, for me.
Mm-hmm.
I feel it evokes emotions that prosaic stories just don't do. And I don't even have any idea what the opera might be like, but there's something about that ambiance that it sets. It's something about that rhythmic landscape that gets me to understand the scenario. And I think that's very vivid in opera. And I
you
think
can
that
listen
we need
to
appreciate that.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
You can listen to Addio del Passato, her mm-hmm. aria from the last act of this opera. You may not have... You can go into that completely cold, have no idea what the dramatic scenario is here, no idea, you know, you may not speak Italian, so we can't understand her words, but the music alone will tell you this woman is dying. There
yeah.
is no mistaking what's happening
yes.
here, because
yes.
the music is so
right.
evocative.
Yep.
And I think that's one
mm-hmm.
of the things that intimidates people about opera is, Well, you know, it's written in Italian. I don't understand Italian. But if you sit there and you watch what's happening on the stage and you listen to the music and the way that they sing it, you will get the story. You might not get the sort of intimate details, but you will know what's going on because the music itself helps tell the story.
There's an inherent level of passion in opera that there isn't any place else. It reminds you of my grandmother. She used to speak to other people in her language. No one understood her language, but they knew exactly what she was talking about, right? And I think opera works the same way.
Yeah.
Somehow it just speaks to you. It just speaks to you.
And also back in the day, Justin mentioned, you know, having heard what we were talking about, you know, he can see it as something on TV or on Netflix. And don't forget, opera in its day, back in the 19th century, the 18th century, that was the Netflix of
yeah.
the time.
You yep, know, yep.
That was the entertainment. You couldn't sit at home mm-hmm. and turn on the Idiot Box.
Quick question, because we're almost out of time. How do our listeners access your podcast?
I'll let the St. John feel that way.
we have a new website, operacheatsheet.com, and we have started to upload podcasts, and that's and you can get in contact with us through
Wonderful.
The website, etc.
Wonderful.
And we're using this as a springboard to get us back into the groove and start
world
doing
domination.
Yes.
Can't
try to take over the world.
Well, St. John and Eric, thank you. You've taken a true story that was fictionalized and retold by Alexandre Dumas, that was retold and improved upon by Giuseppe Verdi, and then presented on Broadway, I think I read somewhere, 16 different versions.
Mm-hmm.
And tonight you dared to retell and improve upon it once again on live radio.
Well, I don't know about improving.
I don't know.
yeah. You've made us laugh. You've expanded our storytelling horizons. You've taken us on a journey, and you've brought us safely home. For all this, we thank you for being on So What's Your Story?
Thank you for inviting us.
And in the spirit of your exuberant storytelling style, we're going to go off the air with the exuberant sounds of La Traviata. Don't touch that dial, because Lars and the Tennyson Tape Deck is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Warren Holloman, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. Thank you.
Helping out at KPFT isn't all meetings and telephones.
One committee works your brain and your body.
And we don't mean throwing things at each other.